Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to tell you a story also. My story doesn't have any bears in it, but it's about carbon, which I hear that bears are mostly made out of, so it's got some of the same elements in it. And it's about global warming and about geological time. So deep time is a hard thing to kind of visualize because human beings have seen such a tiny sliver of the age of the Earth. The Earth is 4 billion years old and humans have been here for 200,000 years or something. And it kind of makes humans seem a little puny, right? And this is sort of a common theme in the history of human self-importance and science. Astronomy tells us that we're not even the center of the solar system, let alone the center of the universe. And biology tells us that we're not really all that different from anybody else, you know, bears or anybody else here. We're built out of the same sort of Legos. Now geology is telling us that it's not at all clear that the Earth was made for us. The Earth was here forever. It's if you took all of Earth history and smushed it down into 24 hours, humans would have seen something like the last 2 seconds of it, just an eye blink. So it sort of seems like things were just going along sort of naturally. Kind of, I'm picturing now not bears, but like a deer and a butterfly and, you know, da 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 da, and then all of a sudden, bang, at the last minute, you've got all this stuff. You've got like shopping malls and parking lots and all that, and it seems like just, but actually, if you look at it, there's been weird stuff going on this planet for a while, for a long time now. It didn't just, the I Love Lucy reruns beaming out to space at the speed of light didn't just sort of come out of nowhere. So all the weirdness has to do with this element carbon. So carbon is what, you know, biology is mostly made out of, and it's the main ingredient in carbon dioxide, which is the gas in the atmosphere that is changing the Earth's climate. So the backstory on this is that we're lucky to have any carbon on Earth at all, because we live in kind of a burned out section of the solar system. The sun, when it was young, was very explosive. And so anything that would get vaporized at 1,000 degrees was just blasted out to the outer planets, out to Jupiter and the gas giant planets. So the Earth, when it was very young, was a total burned out rock, just a cinder, nothing that we see here. And it was only emplaced by what planetary scientists call a late veneer, which is after everything sort of settles down, you kind of sprinkle some fairy dust on the planet, and it brought in, you know, the carbon and the water and the nitrogen, which is most of the atmosphere, basically everything. But carbon, it's a temperamental element. Venus, which is our sister planet, got about as much carbon as we did, but the carbon on Venus is all in the atmosphere. So you could probably swim in the atmosphere of Venus. It's so thick, and so if you could stand the high pressure and the burning temperatures and all of that, it's more like a giant ocean, really, than an atmosphere. And as a result, Venus is very hot. I mean, it's also closer to the sun, and that would make it hot, but there's these intense clouds. There's never a sunny day on Venus. It's like Seattle, only worse. And so Venus would actually be colder than the Earth if it weren't for the intense greenhouse effect of all this CO2. On Earth, the carbon has mostly gone to ground. It's mostly in rocks, in limestones, which are calcium carbonate. These are rocks that have carbon in them. But there's a pinch of carbon on Earth in the atmosphere, which keeps the planet warmer than it would be. And then there's also a pinch of carbon in a very weird, the living carbon pool. And this is something that you never would have expected if you hadn't been a part of it already. Because this tiny little pinch of carbon has totally transformed the planet from what it would be if it were lifeless. And the biggest example of that is oxygen in the atmosphere. There wouldn't be any oxygen in the air if it weren't for for trees growing and making oxygen as part of their lives. And, you know, but this is more than just kind of like, oh yeah, somebody left some oxygen over there. This is sort of more fundamental than that. The biology on Earth has learned how to capture energy from the sun, and by letting oxygen accumulate in the atmosphere, it's sort of like charging up the planet, like a giant battery. And so we are part of this battery. You could go to the store. Actually, when I was a kid, after church, we used to go to the donut shop. But I would rather have you go to a store and buy a candy bar, because on a candy bar, you can see a wrapper, you know, the label. It says that this thing has like 100 calories or something like that. But, and donuts don't have nutritional labels, so not good for my story. But the thing about the candy bar wrapper is that it's not really telling you the truth exactly, because the calories aren't there in the candy bar. You get the calories if you eat the candy bar and breathe the air. But if you were to eat the candy bar on the moon or someplace like that, and there's no oxygen to react with the chocolate in the candy bar, you don't get the 100 calories. So it's kind of like a script that's only good in a company store, right? Or you know, poker chips that are only good in a particular casino or whatever. But it's actually more astonishing than that, the battery of the biosphere, because it seems like it's a regulated battery. If you were to just at random hook up a power source to a battery, probably what would happen is it would blow up. Right, you get too much charge, you exceed the capacity. In the case of the Earth, if you wanted to blow up the battery, the way that would work, the way that would look, would be too much oxygen in the atmosphere. We've got the perfect amount of oxygen in the air. So you get the oxygen when a plant grows, and then you bury the carbon. And so the oxygen that the plant produced when it grew is left behind in the air. So how much oxygen you put in the air is determined by how much dead plants you bury in the earth. And there's no real limit to how much. Be easy to imagine having 10 times more oxygen in the air than we do. But if that ever happened, a little spark of lightning hitting a soggy forest, you know, in a thunderstorm would start a fire that would be unstoppable. It would burn down the whole continent. And pretty sure that it's never been that way on Earth. So not only has the biosphere charged up this battery, it's done it in a way that's sort of controlled and regulated. Oxygen has been around for a long time, half a billion years, and it's stayed within this very narrow range. So one explanation for this comes from a somewhat wacko British geochemist named Jim Lovelock, who has coined the idea of the Gaia hypothesis, that all of life on Earth functions as a single organism that regulates the Earth, the properties of the Earth, to its own optimal advantage, the way the cells in our body regulate our, you know, internal temperatures and our chemistry and whatnot. So on the one hand, life itself is so improbable. If you look at it, you know, with fresh eyes, you never would have believed it to happen. So to imagine that life has gone one step further and actually the whole planet is a giant cooperating organism doesn't seem like that much of a further leap. I mean, if we've already gone so far as life, to go that much further doesn't seem that hard. But it's hard to understand how you get this from an evolutionary point of view, because for one thing, cheaters would have an advantage. If Gaia says, you know, sacrifice some of your energy to make the world better for everybody, and you say, what's to stop that from happening? And then another way to think of it is, in evolution itself is kind of like trial and error. And if you're trying to evolve a planetary size organism, there's no room for error in that. And so it's kind of a, it sort of sits there. It's like a perspective that people have, the Gaia hypothesis. Wondrous thing. There's also another kind of stability that the Earth seems to have, an uncanny sort of eerie stability, which was first identified by Carl Sagan, the astronomer who had the TV show and all of that. He called it the faint young sun paradox. The idea is that stars get brighter as they age, and the astrophysicists aren't going to back down from that. They insist that that's true, so we Earth scientists have to deal with it. What that means is that if the climate is nice today, and if you dial down the sun to make it colder some billions of years ago and kept everything else the same, the Earth would be in deep freeze. So why wasn't it in a deep freeze for the first half of its life or something? Or if it was, you know, a nice climate then, why aren't we boiling now? Somehow, the heat source has been going up and the temperature has been staying stable. So there's at least a partial explanation for this, which it doesn't require this sort of mystical Gaia hypothesis, but it is controlled by the carbon cycle again. And it has to do with the way that carbon goes back and forth between the deep Earth and the atmosphere. So most of it's in the deep Earth, and it sort of dribbles out of the Earth in volcano gases and hot springs at the bottom of the ocean and that kind of thing. And then it goes back into the Earth in the form of those limestone rocks from a chemical reaction called weathering. So you start with an igneous rock like a granite, you know, granite countertops or whatever. If you leave them out in the water, let water wash over them for a long, long, long time, they will slowly turn into carbonate rocks. They'll absorb carbon. And then there's calcium carbonate all over the bottom of the ocean where this stuff is being buried. And so that's the way that the carbon goes back into the Earth. So this all works into a kind of a thermostat that regulates the temperature of the Earth, and it's analogous to a kitchen sink. So you've got a kitchen sink, and you turn on the faucet, and the water starts coming down and going into the sink, and it'll sort of build up in the water, the water will build up in the sink until, as it gets deeper and deeper, hopefully the drain is working well enough that the weight of the water will push it down the drain fast enough that the water level kind of stops rising. It'll find the level at which the budget for the water going through the sink is in balance. And that's what the carbon cycle is doing. And it works because to make the limestone rocks takes lots of water. And it happens more quickly if you have a lush tropical world, lots of CO2 in the air, you know, warm climate all the way to the poles, like the dinosaurs lived in worlds like this. And you have lots of carbon going down the drain in that case. So the carbon in the air finds the level and the climate where you can balance the budget for carbon, just like the water level in the sink finds the level where it's balancing the budget for water in the sink. So we've touched on a couple of things now that relate to the question of climate change in our time. One is, of course, that the fossil fuel that we mine and combine with oxygen in the motors of our cars or power plants or whatever, that's just sort of taking some of the energy out of this global battery of the biosphere. Now, good news here is that we don't have the capacity to drain the battery dry, which would mean using up all the oxygen in the atmosphere. That would be bad. But the fortunate thing is that most of the buried dead plants in the Earth are not really in a form that we can dig up and put into a power plant or a gas tank or whatever. So we can only use up a little tiny fraction of the charge in this battery, the oxygen in the atmosphere. Another touchstone is that the thermostat mechanism that is thought to stabilize the climate through geological time that helps to explain Carl Sagan's faint young sun paradox will ultimately clean up the CO2 from our fossil fuels. But the downside here is that it will take a very long time. So it's kind of like you turn on the faucet and the water is kind of running into the sink and it's, you know, found a nice equilibrated water level. That's the natural world with the deer and the butterfly. And then we come up with a big bucket of water and pretty much dumping it into the sink all at once. So we're putting the water into the sink 100 times faster than it's coming out of the faucet. But there's only so much we can put in. So it's not like we're coming up to it with a giant fire hose and blasting it forever. you know, we just had this, it's an eye blink in time, a sort of small amount of carbon. So a single bucket, dump it in the sink, and the water level would rise, and then it would come down back to its equilibrium again. But how long it takes for that to happen depends on how big the sink is and how quickly the water is running through. So for the kitchen sink, it might take 30 seconds or something to recover. Lake Michigan kind of works like this, and you know, might take 10 years or 50 years or something like that for Lake Michigan water level to change. It turns out that for the CO2 thermostat, it takes hundreds of thousands of years for that thing to work. And we know it has to be, I mean, that's sort of a theoretical calculation, but we know it has to be long like that because we just got finished with these ice ages where the, you know, climate was getting warm and cold and warm and cold, and the CO2 was going up and down and up and down. And this thermostat must have been trying to keep the CO2 level, but it can only go so quickly, and so the ice ages were sort of 100,000 years, and so we know the thermostat has to be kind of slower than that. And that's what will ultimately clean up the fossil fuels, which then takes us back to our first thing we were thinking about, which is geological time. You know, if it's hard to think about deep time in the past, deep time in the future is even weirder because, you know, at least for the past, we have some hope of knowing what happened, whereas for the future, we really don't. So how do you picture this? How do you visualize this? Well, you could sort of slide ourselves mentally in time. The first biological humans appeared some 200,000 years ago, and so we could ask ourselves, how would we feel if they had done something, exploited some resource for a few decades that, you know, made things comfortable for them, but left us a significantly degraded world to this day? Would we be able to get on a high horse of moral indignation and say those people, they were not thinking? Of course not, because they were cavemen, duh. They didn't know what they were doing, right? So, you know, I should chill out and not get all worked up about this. But the idea of knowing, that, see, now we've just touched on the third amazing trick of the carbon cycle that changes everything, makes it so that it's completely impossible to really predict what will truly happen in the future. Because what's happening is that in addition to harvesting and hoarding and storing up energy, the carbon cycle, as exemplified by us, has started collecting and amassing information. The carbon cycle on Earth has become aware of itself and of the universe that spawned it. It seems to me like the eye of the universe is opening right here, right now. Of all the places and all the vastness of time, this is it. It's happening right now. I think of it this way, and I don't feel like science makes me feel puny anymore. It seems like if this is not the center of the universe, it's certainly a center of the universe. An amazing thing to think of. So to conclude, to close, I would like to speak directly to all the carbon atoms in the room. You industrious little rascals, you. Especially, I would like to speak to the sentient carbon atoms in the room. You know who you are. You guys, well, you really should look into this fossil energy business. You know, you're better than that. But other than that, you guys are amazing. Keep up the good work, and have a great day.